Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 80. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around looking at a couple of horror works. The first one is Horrors of the Black Museum from 1959, starring Michael Goff and Greg Kurnow. And then we go to a classic TV movie, the 1972 adaptation of Jeff Rice's novel The Night Stalker, starring Darren McGavin and Barry Atwater. Now sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get the show started after this soundtrack music finishes. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest as genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussion, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hey, how's everybody going? We're doing okay here. It's still summer. Things are still warm and wonderful, and the days are sunny, though. Looking out the window, it's starting to get cloudy now. We may get some rain. Seen a few things at the cinema. I actually went to the cinema yesterday with Sal, and we saw Deadpool, which was a lot of fun. Breaking the fourth wall within a breaking the fourth wall was great. The movie kind of really works, and one of the interesting things about the film as well, apart from all of the kind of fun superhero hijinks that are in there, is that they cut the budget by $7 million at the last minute. And so the guys had to make some changes to it, change some of the action sequences, change it because they're the fairly expensive ones, do all that kind of stuff, and made the film better, which is really interesting. The script had been in pre-production hell for about 7 years, and the guys just made some changes because of this budget restriction that came through. And from all reports, it improved the film, which, you know, is pretty wonderful. I recommend the film. It's a bit of fun. I know our friend online, Rodrigo, didn't enjoy it, but everybody else that I know has seen it had a lot of fun watching it. And we've reached that stage in the cycle of superhero movies where having a kind of fun, transgressive, R-rated, in American sense, not in Australian sense, but R-rated superhero movie was something that the time had come to do. And Ryan Reynolds is very good in it. Marina Baccarin is good. It really does work well. And if you're in the sort of frame of mind to watch a fun silly superhero film, which has great titles at the front, the titles at the start, I'm not going to spoil, but they do work really well and take the piss out of the genre while being within the genre. So we saw that, and Sal and I had a good time down at the local cinema. The other thing I did, which is probably a bit of a mistake, is that I reformatted the operating system and the hard drive on the computer that I record the podcast on, which is an Asus all-in-one, so the computer and the monitor are the same thing. And it was running a little bit slow. I was filling it up with rubbish that didn't relate to podcasting at all. So I thought I'd clean it all off, and then, of course, I had about 12 billion zillion quadrillion updates to do on the thing. And it's taken me about 4 hours since I started sitting down to record the podcast to get all the updates through and to do all of that kind of stuff, and to get the machine to the stage at which I could do the podcast. Then I looked at my backup and some of the little files I put in every week, the stuff that with the contact details and the Patreon subscribers and all of that, didn't copy through in the backup for some reason. They were in a subfolder, which didn't come through, so I've had to record all of those again. Hopefully I can get the Patreon supporter part back from the previous podcast and just cut and paste that from the previous one. But things have been a major hassle, and even though now and then with Windows-based machines particularly, you've got to go and kind of clean out the crap every now and then by reformatting the stupid things. It is a major hassle and a real problem at times. Now, I'm just going to strike a match here because I'm lighting my little scented candle that I always have on when I'm recording podcasts. This particular one is called Mandarin Tea, and it's got a kind of citrusy flavor about it and makes things smell nice when I'm recording the podcast to combat the smells that may come from my body at various times while I'm recording. And I know you all really wanted to hear that. So this time around, I forget who it was, and I apologize for forgetting who it was. My correspondence is all over the place with the Patreon supporters, but somebody who's a supporter of the podcasts at the Patreon campaign at patreon.com/paleocinema plug suggested that I do Horrors in the Black Museum, Horrors of the Black Museum, a 1959 British film starring Michael Goff and June Cunningham, Graham Curnow, Shirley Ann Field. So I'm doing it, and fulfilling that, I am going to try over the next few podcasts to get the backlog of suggestions from the supporters and do at least one of those movies during each of the podcasts, just to kind of clear the decks and make way for other things, and also to fulfill the obligation. So I'm doing that. The other film is one that I picked because I started watching the TV series of Kolchak the Night Stalker, and I thought, why don't I do the Night Stalker movie, the first one that came out, the one directed by John Llewellyn Moxey and with Barry Atwater and Carolyn Lee and Ralph Meeker and all of those people. And, of course, the legendary and irreplaceable Darren McGavin as Karl Kolchak. And so I did. I rewatched that. I also rewatched The Night Strangler, which is the second of the movies. And I watched a couple of episodes of Kolchak the Night Stalker. And they haven't dated particularly. They're really nicely balanced. On a TV budget, they've done remarkable things with them. And the... Yeah, how occasionally you'll go back and revisit things you saw at an earlier time and realise that, no, they don't stand up. Well, that person was a sexist twat. That person was racist. That person was a bad actor. The special effects are too ropey to believe. You know, you get all of those kind of caveats that your mind, many decades later, kind of comes up with about particular works. I didn't have any of that with this movie, and that's the lovely thing about it and why I'm really looking forward to talking about it. It holds up really, really well, and is a lot of fun. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I'll come back and talk about a couple of other things that I've watched before I get into the first of the two movies, being Horrors of the Black Museum, a British film from my favourite titled company in the UK, Anglo Amalgamated Productions.
Better wait a minute. You better hold the phone. Better mind your manners. Better change your tone. Don't you threaten me, son. You got a lot of gold. We're gonna do things my way.
skin, boy. You want to save your hide. You want to see tomorrow. You better step aside. Better take a tip, boy. Want some good advice. You better take it easy. Cause you're walking on thin ice.
That, of course, was Levi Stubbs with Mean Green Mother from Outer Space from Little Shop of Horrors, the musical.
If you have nerve enough, come down these stairs with me to the Black Museum. And if you dare, look around this chamber of horrors. You will see the lethal possessions of a man possessed with murder.
This is a U-trailer advertising an X-certificate film. We regret we cannot show you now the scene as it appears in the picture.
New sensation! Killer strikes again!
We have to tell you the story of a man whose hobby is murder. A killer who held London in terror.
We repeat, as this is a U-trailer advertising an X-certificate film, we regret we cannot show you now the scene as it appears in the picture.
Here was a modern Jekyll and Hyde who killed so that he could write with relish about his victims and his crimes.
Clever. Fiendishly clever.
Ingenious enough to give us the third brutal murder in 2 weeks.
Aren't these similar to the pair you have in your Black Museum?
Starring Michael Goff. A killer who shopped for his weapons in London's backstreet antique shops.
To experience all the horrors of the Black Museum, you must see the complete film.
June Cunningham, the blonde who got to know him too well and talked too much.
You thief!
Oh, come on, dearie. Show me how fast you can chase him out of the room now.
Give me back my cake!
Not until I've told you everything. Been saving it up for you. Without your cane, you're only half a man. Without your money, you'd be no man at all.
Graham Curnow, the boy hypnotized into obeying his master's murderous voice. Shirley Ann Field, innocent victim of young love, enticed into the nightmare horror of the Black Museum.
Rick! Why did you bring a stranger down here, you stupid fool? You know I never allow any outsider to snoop around my workshop. This Black Museum is our private world. And now, thanks to you, it has been invaded.
I like that trailer. It really beats up the movie nicely. It bangs a drum for it in an interesting way. Horrors of the Black Museum is a 1959 British horror film starring Michael Goff, June Cunningham, Graham Curnow and Shirley Ann Field, as the trailer said. There's a film critic called David Puri who said that this was part of Anglo Amalgamated's Sadian trilogy because there was an emphasis in the horror movies of sadism, cruelty and violence with sexual undertones. The three movies he puts in this trilogy are Horrors of the Black Museum, Circus of Horrors, which I think I've talked about on a podcast before with Anton Differing, and Peeping Tom, the Michael Powell movie. Now, these movies have nothing in common with each other, apart from the fact that they're horror films with certain kind of saucy aspect to them. But apart from that, they're not really in any way thematically linked. This movie stars, of course, Michael Goff, who people remember from a number of horror movies. In fact, he was in the first Hammer Dracula movie with Christopher Lee. And if you see that movie, he's not very good in it. He's really kind of the weak link in the acting part of that film. But in this one, he gets to chew the scenery a lot as a thriller writer, Edmund Bancroft, who owns a private black museum of torture instruments and displays. He hypnotizes his assistant Rick, played by Graham Curnow, to commit increasingly horrific crimes for Bancroft to write about. Well, they're not crimes, they're murders, in fact. And more specifically, they're murders of women. There's a scene right at the start where you see a postman delivering a parcel to an attractive girl who lives in a flat with her flatmate. And the parcel contains a pair of binoculars. The girl puts the binoculars up to her face and two enormous spikes spring out of them, pierce through her eyeballs and into her brain and kill her, while her flatmate, a French girl, screams. So you get that's the kind of movie this is. And of course at the time it was very shocking and horrifying and all that kind of thing, but it's the sort of thing you'd see in a TV episode these days. According to the poster for Horrors of the Black Museum, it was filmed in Hypno Vista, which basically means it was a CinemaScape film in colour, but they called it Hypno Vista as one of those kind of beat-ups for the posters. Movies were done that way. There was Hypno Vista, there was Cinerama, there was Hypnorama, there was Cinevision, Supervision, Supercolor. Basically, the promos were all there to tell people that this was not a TV screen you were watching. This is something special. It's on a big screen and there's some special process like Hypno Vista, which makes it even better than that. Now, the movie was produced and co-written by Herman Cohen, a kind of schlockmeister movie maker whose oeuvre includes some really interesting things. Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla with Sammy Petrillo and Duke Mitchell, of course. Let's Target Earth, Crime of Passion, I Was a Teenage Werewolf, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, How to Make a Monster, The Headless Ghost, Conga, which is a kind of giant ape movie set in London, again starring Michael Goff, A Study in Terror, Black Zoo as well with Michael Goff in it. I should do Black Zoo at some stage. A Study in Terror, which is not a bad film as well. It's a Sherlock Holmes movie. Berserk, Django Il Bastardo, 1969, which is a spaghetti western, of course. Trog and Craze, a really weird, sadistic horror film starring Jack Palance. But that's the kind of thing Herbert Cohen did. He wrote the script along with a jobbing screenwriter called Aben Kandel, who had written a lot of those films as well, but had also contributed to things like Magnificent Obsession. He started out in the studios in the 1930s and wrote episodes for Studio One, Man from U.N.C.L.E., The Untouchables and things like that. Herman Cohen originally wanted Vincent Price to play the role of the villain in this piece, and then wanted Orson Welles, but the studios had a weird deal to make this film. Half of the budget was put up by Nat Cohen and Stuart Levy at Anglo Amalgamated. The other half was put up by AIP, American International Pictures. So the Anglo Amalgamated guys, Nat Cohen and Stuart Levy, said, no, no, we want an English actor to play the villain. So Cohen found Michael Goff, decided to go with him, and used him in a couple of other pictures as well. A lot of people remember Michael Goff more for a role he played late in his life when he was the butler Alfred in the Tim Burton Batman movie and a couple of the sequels as well, toward the end of his life. But that was kind of a very atypical role for Michael Goff, who had a tendency in earlier things, and in the horror movies in particular, to chew the scenery and spit it out at the camera, which indeed he does in this film as well. His Bancroft is a nasty piece of work. He's sarcastic. He talks to the coppers about the true crime novels he writes. He teases them with it. He's misogynistic. He's cut a cute blonde called Joan, played by June Cunningham, as a piece on the side, but she's not his class, so he doesn't introduce her to his friends and just keeps her there. Basically, the implication being, of course, to shag, and she gets pissed off with that. Now, the interesting thing is June Cohen in this film, and she's one of the aspects of the film that I found quite interesting. First off, she was one of those kind of pneumatic blondes of the late 1950s they had in England, a pin-up model, and who knows what else. Not a good actor at all. She couldn't act her way out of a parking ticket. And she does have a dance scene when she kind of has the argument that you see in the trailer with Bancroft, and then goes out to a little club and they have a Rockola jukebox there, and they put on some La Dolce Vita style music, and she dances in high heels and a tight red dress to kind of pick up guys there. Doesn't end up being successful with it. But one of the problems is June Cunningham couldn't dance. And watching her kind of prance around to the music in a pair of high heels and a tight red dress, which is supposed to be sexy, doesn't really come across that way. Maybe it did in 1959. Who knows? Guys were less selective about their pneumatic blondes in those days, I suppose. But seeing it from our viewpoint, it's kind of really odd. And she's trying to do the La Dolce Vita thing, even though this film was filmed around the time of La Dolce Vita. But it really doesn't kind of work. She didn't have much of a film career after this, for reasons that become obvious when you see the movie. And in the film, she doesn't have too much of a future either, because she comes to a sticky end. I'm not going to spoil it, but she comes to a sticky end for a couple of reasons, one of which is for shaming. Bancroft has a disability, has something wrong with his leg and walks with a cane. And, you know, apart from being a sadistic murderer, she shames him for his disability. So we're not entirely one way or the other when she ends up being killed, because she's basically criticized a lot of the wrong aspects of the guy that who's been looking after her and basically has been keeping her in her flat at the time. But of course, in 1959, that played very saucy. He was a wealthy, successful upper class man with a kind of working class girl ensconced in a flat for his personal pleasure. So that would have played as kind of very transgressive at the time. And then she kind of has a go at him because of his disability and because he's not a full man, which kind of brings up the subtext that maybe he's impotent and has her there for reasons of sadism rather than anything else. And there are all sorts of sexual undercurrents in this film that make it really interesting. There's a relationship with his personal assistant and kind of Trilby character, played by Graham Curnow, and his name is Rick. And the relationship between them, where Edmund Bancroft basically hypnotizes and drugs him to, in a Jekyll and Hyde kind of way, and that gets referenced in the movie as well. So not only do you have this murder aspect, you've got this Jekyll and Hyde thing going. And Rick, played by Graham Curnow, is an interesting character as well. He was the long-time partner, and they were together for about 40-odd years, of Victor Spinetti, an English actor who you might have seen in Help, the Beatles movie. He did a couple of movies with the Beatles as well. He's known as a comedian and an actor. Very well liked, and he and Graham Curnow were very well liked as a couple as well. They were never closeted at all. They went out and about and lived their lives as they chose to, together as partners, and they were together right up until Victor Spinetti's death. So good on them, which is probably one of the reasons why Graham Curnow, when he is in a romantic scene with Shirley Ann Field, who was incredibly attractive, if not wonderfully gifted as an actor, he shows a certain lack of enthusiasm about those clinches. Shirley Ann Field, you might remember, was also in The Damned, with playing the sister of Oliver Reed's character, who gets involved with McDonald Carey's character in the movie, the Joseph Losey film that Hammer did in about 1963. And yeah, very, very attractive woman. And her name's Angela. Angela wants to marry Rick, of course. You know, they're in love together. And she wants to help him in his work, but she doesn't understand the nature of his work, which mostly consists of doing whatever the hell Michael Goff's character wants him to, up to and including putting a doctor in a vat of acid to get the meat off the bone so they can put his skeleton into the horrors of the Black Museum display. The murder of the doctor is rather interesting too. There's a great big machine that Bancroft has in the museum, which serves no other purpose except to kill the doctor, and serves no other purpose in the movie. This movie is a kind of mix and match thing. It's like they threw a whole bunch of ideas together and hoped that they'd stick together. They hadn't necessarily done that. They didn't stick particularly well, the ideas, but you've got to admire the fact that they had a go at it. And yeah, the movie was meant to be kind of sexy and horrific and monstrous and gory and all the things that it almost is. And the weirdest thing about it is the bits where he hypnotizes Rick and then turns him into a monster and gets him to commit the murders on his behalf, him being Bancroft, comes in the last reel. There's no kind of foreshadowing. There's no hinting at any of this. As far as we know up to that point, Rick's just a browbeaten assistant to Michael Goff's Bancroft character. He's trying to get up in the world. He's trying to learn a trade, which I suppose is crime writing. Yeah, Bancroft and he have a very interesting relationship with not unsexual undercurrents to it, which is kind of interesting. The way Bancroft reacts when he finds out that Rick has a relationship with Angela is very telling in this. So not only does Bancroft have a woman he can't please in a flat, he also has these kind of feelings of betrayal when his young male assistant builds a relationship and tries to build a future with Angela, played by Shirley Ann Field. So there are all those kind of little bits and pieces there which they would have knowingly put in there, particularly the actors, knowing Graham Curnow's sexuality. He was never in the closet. There's some interesting undercurrents there which play kind of better to a 21st century audience than they did at the time, because a lot of people were clueless. I know this from my childhood. A lot of people were clueless about alternative sexualities, and where they weren't clueless, they were incredibly judgmental, and some people said they were sickened by homosexuality and things like that. So there were all of those extreme reactions to alternative sexualities, which for those who understood what was going on in this movie, would have kind of enhanced the transgressiveness of the film at the time, which was what it was about. It was about getting bums on seats. It was about generating word of mouth and through that making money. And of course, that's what the game was for these people, the exploitation filmmakers at the time. But the movie does kind of have a certain weirdness about it. It has the colour stock that they use is particularly English. There's something about the way the film looks that is very English, which is kind of strange because in the American version of this film, which AIP did, there was a 13-minute prologue added to the movie to extend the length. It wasn't a particularly long film, featuring a hypnotist called Emil Franchel and Hypnovista. James Nicholson, who ran AIP, said the movie needed another gimmick. We tested in a few theatres and the audience went for it like crazy, hokey though it was, said Herman Cohen. It helped to make the picture a success, I guess, because people were looking for gimmicks at that time. And that's what it is. It is a very gimmicky movie. And it's, looking at it now, it's hilarious rather than horrifying. And you can kind of sit back and look at it from the 21st century viewpoint and see the misogyny and sadism of Edmund Bancroft. There's also a really nice scene, and I almost forgot to mention this, and I apologise. There's some scenes in an antique shop with an antique shop owner called Aggie, played by a character actress, Beatrice Varley, who basically sells Bancroft some of the weapons with which the murders are created, and then at one stage tries to blackmail him regarding that. And this is where the movie really does liven up. You've got Michael Goff and Beatrice Varley playing off each other. There's a kind of sadistic nature of Bancroft playing off against the kind of mercenary nature of Aggie. And, those scenes kind of very much pop in the film. They're much better than the scenes where Michael Goff is playing against less experienced actors. There are some of the coppers are very interesting character actors as well. There's Jeffrey Keane, who later turned up in a number of James Bond films. He plays the main police inspector looking into things. And, you know, just some familiar faces. The names aren't particularly known, but familiar faces from 1950s English B-movies turn up there. The set designs are very good, too. And one of the things that English studios had really nailed down pat is the set designs. The flats people live in, Aggie's antique shop cluttered with stuff, the Black Museum with its kind of dummies and torture instruments and displays of knives and all that kind of thing. It's all done very well on a relatively low budget. But the movie is very much of a time. Apparently the budget was roughly $164,000 estimated, it says here in Wikipedia. And the box office for it went over $1 million. So most of that would have been possibly in the United States. But either way, the movie was kind of successful for what it was. It's a Grand Guignol kind of thing. But still, I'm yet to be convinced that Michael Goff, I think he's a very stagey kind of actor, but I think it's suitable for this, particularly this kind of role. And the movie plays well. I watched it twice because the first time I watched it very late at night and I fell asleep through a couple of bits of it and then woke up and I rewatched the whole thing again, and it moves along at a brisk pace. It's a lot of fun. It doesn't need that 30-minute prologue about Hypnovista to make it a good, short, solid little film which ends in an amusement park, and a lot of good thrillers end in amusement parks. This one does it kind of well. And one of the things for me that I find interesting is seeing what amusement parks looked like in the 1950s in England in particular. And there's not enough little bits where I can see what's going on in the stalls and the games of chance and the things like that in there. That's the kind of stuff that I find very interesting. And also the way people are dressed, because there were a lot of extras. There was a lot of crowd scenes at that last bit. And just seeing the way people dressed at the time is kind of interesting too. But just to wind it up, a nice solid little thriller, kind of lots of undercurrents of perversity, not necessarily only sexual, but sadism and nastiness and weak characters, strong characters, attractive women, women who can't dance, decapitations, people with their eyes poked out. You can't really ask for more, can you? So I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about The Night Stalker.
Chapter 1. This is the story behind one of the greatest manhunts in history. Maybe you read about it, or rather what they let you read about it, probably is some minor item buried somewhere on a back page. However, what happened in that city between May 16th and May 28th of this year was so incredible that to this day the facts have been suppressed in a massive effort to save certain political careers from disaster and law enforcement officials from embarrassment. This will be the last time I will ever discuss these events with anyone. So when you have finished this bizarre account, judge for yourself its believability. And then try to tell yourself, wherever you may be, it couldn't happen here.
Sunday, May 16th. At approximately 2:30 a.m., Cheryl Hughes was standing at the intersection of Casino Center and Fremont Streets waiting for a girlfriend to give her a lift home. Cheryl Hughes was 23, 5 feet 5 and 1 half inches tall, 118 pounds, blonde hair, light brown eyes, swing shift change girl at the Gold Dust Saloon. Cheryl Hughes, tired and hungry, but just mad enough to walk the 8 blocks to her small frame house off the corner of 9th and Bridger. Cheryl Hughes, en route to her doom.
There's a trivia question I like to ask, which immensely and monumentally and comprehensively pisses off Star Trek fans. I'll walk up to a Star Trek fan I know and say, who was the first captain of the Enterprise on television? And they'll go, Geoffrey Hunter played Christopher Pike, blah, 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 blah. And I go, no, Darren McGavin in Riverboat, 1960. Which is another reason to love Darren McGavin. You can do a kind of lateral trivia question about him. The Night Stalker was a TV movie based on a then-unpublished novel by Jeff Rice called The Kolchak Papers. The movie was incredibly successful. It was the highest-rating TV movie up to that point of 1972. And there's a number of good reasons why. First off, you've got Richard Matheson doing the teleplay. If you don't know who Richard Matheson is, pause the podcast for a moment and take a look at the man's IMDb page. He was a script-writing god as far as horror, fantasy, and to a certain extent science fiction is concerned. He wrote The Incredible Shrinking Man. He wrote I Am Legend. Just a lot of things here. And he was a jobbing scriptwriter in Hollywood as well. And Richard Matheson's the guy who sets the tone for this as well. Now, the director was John Llewellyn Moxie, a guy born in Argentina, but who had a long career, particularly in television directing. And he does a really nice job in this one as well. And the cast is exceptional, apart from Darren McGavin, about whom not enough good things can be said. You've got Carol Lindley playing his girlfriend, Gail Foster. Simon Oakland playing Tony Vincenzo, his editor. Ralph Meeker's in there as well, playing a cop called Bernie Jenks. Ralph Meeker we know from Kiss Me Deadly and any number of other things as well. Simon Oakland, the good character actor as well. Claude Akins playing the Sheriff Butcher. And Claude Akins, again, another great character actor who in real life was totally the opposite from the characters he played. He was a very likable and knowledgeable man. He liked playing chess. He got on very well with people and was incredibly well regarded personally and professionally. You've got Kent Smith in there, who people might remember was in Val Luton's The Cat People, amongst other things. Elisha Cook Jr., we all know who he is. Larry Linville, who was, of course, in MASH, playing one of the doctors. And then you have a character actor, a tall character actor, whose career stretched for about 30 years, called Barry Atwater, playing Yanis Gorzeny, who is the vampire of the piece. And this is, in case you weren't aware, a vampire story. The setup plays a little bit like Chuck Tatum, the journalist we see in Ace in the Hole, the Billy Wilder movie, also known as The Big Carnival, starring Kirk Douglas. He's a journalist who was very successful in New York and is down on his luck and is working for a relatively minor newspaper in Las Vegas for Tony Vincenzo. And Kolchak is looking for a way back into the big time. He wants to go back to New York. He wants to get his career back on track. He's, at the time, Darren McGavin was 50, so he's got a kind of weathered character look. He's, they were originally going to dress him in shorts and a Hawaiian shirt, but Darren McGavin looked at the character, thought it through, and thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a slightly dated suit, with the assumption that Kolchak is wearing a suit that he worn years before when he was more successful in New York. And then they put the straw hat on there because, apart from anything else, you notice this in Night Stalker, but not the TV series. In Night Stalker, Darren McGavin's got a comb over rather than the really nice rug that he wears in the TV series. So having the hat there kind of obviated a lot of the problems you have with comb overs and things like that. And it's still, and it's very much a part of the character, that kind of cheap straw hat that he wears. And one of the other big, really good aspects of it is the voiceover. There was an attempt to remake The Night Stalker in 2005. They were kind of doing a reboot, and it didn't work well for a couple of reasons, the biggest one of which is the tongue-in-cheek narration. And the fact that if you have a listen to the theme, which I played at the start of the podcast, from the TV series The Night Stalker, Kolchak The Night Stalker, you'll see that it starts out with Kolchak whistling. He's kind of happy-go-lucky, lightly kind of, you know, just kind of walking through the office at night to write his story. And then the music gets more and more serious and kind of dreadful, and things start happening around him. And the fan freezes, the lighting changes, and all that kind of stuff. And that's basically what the series is. It's got a light touch to it, but it's nonetheless got horror in it as well. And all of that cemented together by Darren McGavin's kind of tour de force acting as Karl Kolchak. He's intelligent. They throw in a number of references to movies as well. They mention the screenwriter Ben Hecht, for instance, in The Front Page, and all sorts of other little bits like that, which kind of show that he's an educated man. He's smart, he's resourceful, and he's driven to get the story, regardless of the impediments they're put in his way, whether it's the authorities, whether it's cover-ups, whatever it is. The one flaw in the way Karl Kolchak goes about things is he doesn't care about anything except the victims. He does have a compassionate spot for the victims, and he does speak of them with some compassion. And the story, the truth, is a very important thing to him. And, in fact, it's crucial to his character. And there's some nice bits in the original movie as well, with him and his relationship with the Carol Lindley character. And it's a side of Kolchak we don't necessarily see in the TV series, because it's Monster of the Week kind of stuff with the TV series. You do see it in The Night Strangler, the sequel, which is set in Seattle, in the relationship that Kolchak has with Joanne Flug's character, who's an exotic dancer in Seattle. But, yeah, it's nice having that well-roundedness at the start of things, so that when ABC did the TV series and it became Monster of the Week, and there wasn't that time to have character development for Kolchak, the two telly movies, The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler, established that for us, so that when you go, when you should watch them in sequence like that. When you get into the TV series, where it is Monster of the Week, and not to disparage it, it's very good Monster of the Week, but nonetheless, it is Monster of the Week stuff. You know who Kolchak is, you know his backstory, you know that he's a crusading journalist with no dress sense, no sense of, no respect for bureaucracy, no respect for people who kind of hide the truth and don't think the public has a right to know. He's a kind of crusading journalist with his tongue in his cheek and with a sarcastic nature, and he's abrupt and kind of not nasty, but impatient with bureaucracy and impatient with people who just do what's necessary but don't go beyond what's necessary. He's a crusader in the truest sense of the word, and that's one of the things we love about him. And Richard Matheson's script gives that to us. The voiceover narration is crucial to this as well. It's not, in a sense, narration. It's Kolchak reading us his newspaper story, in a sense. And that makes it work. The fact that it's not just purely a narration there for the audience, it's a man doing his job. And we're hearing what he does for his job. And we're hearing the kind of lyrical nature and slightly kind of sarcastic tone of Karl Kolchak's journalism that really makes this work fantastically well. Of course, all the cops and everybody are doing a cover-up. Cover-ups were very big at this time. This is about the time when the Watergate scandal broke out, and the impact on that on popular culture cannot be underestimated. We knew that the corruption was out there. It had been at the highest levels of the American government. It was demonstrated being at the highest levels of the American government, and so crusaders were the heroes at the time. You had all the President's Men, which came out about it, of course. But having a crusading journalist as a protagonist in a horror TV series was a brilliant touch. And it was right on point with the zeitgeist. Right at that time, it was the right kind of character to have in the right kind of show. Now, McGovern was a character actor with a long history. One of the favourite roles I have with Darren McGovern is he played a drug dealer in Man with the Golden Arm, which you can download without any karmic backlash from YouTube because it's in the public domain. Movie where Frank Sinatra plays a drug addict. And Darren McGovern has a small but very important role as the drug pusher. And he is brilliant in that. He really is a nasty piece of work, and it shows the talent the man had. Of course, he'd done a number of things on television before this, Riverboat, of course, a couple of crime shows, that kind of thing. But going back to his early career in 1955 with The Man with the Golden Arm, really, like Brian Keith in a sense, he was one of those character actors that wasn't good looking enough to play a matinee idol, but had incredible skills as an actor. And really ended up in television because that's where people who weren't as pretty as movie stars could get a job if they were very good. And, he was well-loved and well-respected as an actor. He was an unashamed left-wing liberal, liberal Democrat. He played tennis. He was very well-regarded in the industry. People might also remember him for things like he did a couple of episodes of The X-Files, in recognition of Kolchak the Night Stalker, of course, and was the father in The Christmas Story, who are a great, well-loved Christmas movie. But for me, there are a couple of things I'm remembering for. One is, of course, Man with the Golden Arm, but also playing Karl Kolchak. And there's that beautiful rapport and chemistry that he has with Simon Oakland playing his editor, and who long-suffering editor, let's say long-suffering editor, Tony Vincenzo. And the nice thing about watching both telly movies and then some of the series, which I'm re-watching at the moment, is to see the way that that relationship develops and evolves over time. At the end of the second telly movie, The Night Strangler, Vincenzo, the Joanne Flew character, and Kolchak have been driven out of Seattle, as indeed they were driven out of Las Vegas at the end of The Night Stalker. And are in a car heading for New York because there was going to be a third part to the telly movies where Kolchak and Vincenzo were back in New York. But that would never came about. The TV series came about instead. But that's just the setup for this, because there's some really cool bits in this particular mystery regarding the vampire and the slow evolving discovery that, yes, there is a vampire working in Las Vegas. And he's killing women, and every time the cops corner him, he takes any number of bullets and he can't be killed. He's very strong, very quick, and a kind of implacable antagonist for the police force. There's a scene where they find the corpse of one of the victims in a patch of sand in an irrigation ditch, and there are no footprints, and a purse is found 22 feet away. And the implication, of course, is that the vampire drained her and then threw her 22 feet into this culvert. And that's kind of cool as well, the fact that they set that up nicely, and the fact that Matheson's script gives us that. And then we start seeing, the first time we see the face of the vampire, Jonas Gozeni, played by Barry Atwater, is very cool as well. He's got bloodshot black eyes. He's got a pale face with some veins on it and things like that. It's a really nice, but not heavy-handed piece of makeup work. And the third thing that makes the vampire in this show, or in this TV movie, work really well is they made exactly the same choice that was made for different reasons in the 1966 Hammer Dracula movie, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, in that the vampire never speaks in the movie. You see him snarl, you see him growl, you see him groan, but you never actually hear him speak. He doesn't explain himself. He doesn't tell you about children of the night. None of that stuff. He's a primal force. He's pure hunger and power. And that's another reason why this works so well. You don't have the vampire humanized. You see him purely as a predator, and comparing him with the kind of very human, articulate, and flawed Kolchak, the contrasts are very marked there, and it works really, really well for that very reason, which is one of the reasons why the Night Strangler is a little bit weaker. When we do catch up with Dr. Richard Malcolm, who's the villain of the piece in Night Strangler, he talks and he explains himself, and that slows down the story to a certain extent. Whereas using his smarts, which are more extensive to a certain extent than the police are, and we find throughout the Night Stalker that Kolchak is on parallel with the police, if not one step ahead of them. And eventually when he finds the old house, which is like no house that was ever in Las Vegas, there aren't any old derelict houses like that in Las Vegas. Las Vegas was basically a desert crossroads until 1948. So in 1972, when this movie came out, there weren't any old derelict houses like that in Las Vegas. When we find the old derelict house that Scorsese is in, and Kolchak kind of goes through the very decrepit and weird and horrible place, there is a nice tension, because they spend a good 10 minutes or so of Kolchak, well, it seems like 10 minutes if it's not 10 minutes, but they spend a good deal of time of Kolchak looking through the house and taking photos with his little Instamatic camera, and kind of wandering through the place before he's brought to the attention of Scorsese the vampire. And that's great too, because that tension builds up. It tells us a little bit about him. It shows us the grave with the grave dirt in it, with the native soil in it. It shows us the kind of place, and through that, the kind of being that this vampire is, before we see the vampire himself. And one of the other things too about, particularly, and all through the series as well, the Night Stalker, Night Strangler, and Kolchak, the Night Stalker's TV series, there's some really top stunt work in this film. And there are bits where Kolchak falls down the stairs and the vampire leaps at him from the top of the stairs. And the kind of fight scenes are at least as good as any in other TV works of the time. You've got a lot of that kind of stuff in there that really makes this work. And the fact that they filmed a lot of this on location as well. There are some location scenes, particularly the first murder and a bunch of other stuff in there, which is does give a kind of real verisimilitude to this thing. It's not just all filmed on a backlot at Universal Studios or anything like that. It really kind of works incredibly well. And one of the other things you got to love about Kolchak, which I may not have mentioned, is how resourceful he is. He knows who's bribable in the city bureaucracy, and he has friendships at a certain level with those people. And that kind of works as well. You know, the fact that he meets the Ralph Meeker character at a, you know, kind of hotel swimming pool area where they sit down and have a beer together, those kind of relationship establishing moments are very much in as a part of this film as well. And one of the other things I thought about when I was watching this movie for the podcast was that the time this film was being filmed is within a year or so of the same time that Hunter S. Thompson was in Las Vegas, and the events played out that he slightly fictionalized for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So the Las Vegas we see in The Night Stalker is the Hunter S. Thompson era, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas era Las Vegas. The way people dress, the casinos, the bright lights, the tourists, all that kind of stuff is that era, which is kind of fun. And I noticed, I was looking at the signs, you know how when you see old movies set in Las Vegas, you look and see who the famous people are up on the billboards and who they got there. They don't have any particularly famous ones in The Night Stalker, but as the first victim is walking past the Gold Nugget Casino, there's one of the acts that are displayed on the billboard is a group called the Nonchalants. And I thought that is such a cool name for a group, whether it's a band or whether it's a dance troupe, to call them the Nonchalants. I think that kind of really does kind of send out a kind of doo-wop vibe about things. And it's very much of the time. Now, to get back to the 2005 version of the Night Stalker. The reason it didn't work is it didn't have that light touch. It didn't have that kind of whimsy about it. It was trying to take itself too seriously. And one of the reasons why the whole Kolchak thing works is because it did have that combination of humor and horror. It had the wonderfulness of Darren McGavin's Kolchak balanced against the fact that at one stage, and this is one of the most famous things, the one that people talk about most when I'm talking about Kolchak the Night Stalker to them, when he's sewing the lips of a zombie up after he's filled its mouth with salt. There's those kind of moments of incredible bravery that Kolchak shows, even though he's not an action hero in any real sense of the word. He's in a sense, and in a certain way, a kind of clown journalist crusader. He's not taken seriously because he's got no dress sense, and he's abrupt and angry and all those things that bureaucrats don't want to see. And yet he is incredibly heroic as well. He will go and do what's necessary to stop the murders from happening in each case. And that's one of the things I like about them. He's a crusader for the truth, but also a crusader for justice in a cheap seersucker suit and a straw hat. That's one of the reasons why we love Night Stalker in particular. And I like the character actors are fantastic. Getting Elisha Cook Jr. in and Kent Smith, these people know the previous history of the genre, which is kind of cool. And even in The Night Strangler, if you have a look at the cast that they have in The Night Strangler as well, you've got Scott Brady in there, Wally Cox, Margaret Hamilton, who played the witch in Wizard of Oz, is in there, John Carradine, Al Lewis, Virginia Peters as well, who's got a long genre history. It's just a very cool lot of people involved in this stuff. And it's something that we, humor and horror is a hard one to get right. You either go slapstick and ridiculous, in which case the horror doesn't seem horrifying at all, or you go the other way and things get a little too serious. I mean, there are movies that do it really well, combining the two. Things like Tucker and Dale versus Evil, for instance, work really well. Some of the lower budget stuff like Zombievers does pretty much okay with it. There are ways of doing horror and comedy together, but it's easier to get right than it is. Sorry, it's easier to get it wrong than it is to get it right. And it's a balancing act which it takes real skill and takes a good script to get right. And, of course, good actors and good effects and all the other bits and pieces. The last thought I had about this before I end the podcast is I like the fact that Night Stalker, Night Strangler and the Kolchak TV series were working to do a horror series under the stupid and extreme censorship that American television had at the time. You really should read Harlan Ellison's essay books, The Glass Teat and The Other Glass Teat, to see the kind of dumbed down and ridiculous stuff American TV was putting out at the time. The fact that this and other horror shows, Trilogy of Terror being another one, I talked about that in a previous Martian Drive-In. The fact that they managed to get across what they were trying to get across and to build where they couldn't show horror and gore, they built suspense up. And the suspense is what really works in this. And I like that. I don't mind a bit of gore. I think censorship is horrible. But in the same way that Deadpool was improved by having this budget cut, and by forcing the people writing the script to come up with innovations that actually improve the script, the censorship limitations on something like The Night Stalker were something that people overcame by working harder and working smarter and working their ways through the cracks and around the corners of the roadblocks and the barricades that were put in their way. And I really love and respect that. And I think that that skill set is something, even when you don't have the censorship problems and the limitations, you don't have the budgetary limitations. I think it's something that filmmakers should always consider. How can we do this smarter and easier? How can we not throw money at a problem, but throw our minds at a problem? And I think that that's what makes good cinema work, the fact that people use their brains rather than their budgets. But anyway, that's about it for the podcast. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. I'll be back in a... Hang on, I've forgotten. Let me stop there. I've got feedback. We've got feedback from our friend Armin in Germany. And I'm going to play Armin's feedback. Before we end the podcast, I was getting ahead of myself there. I wanted to sit back and play the Xbox instead of finishing the podcast. And for that, I abjectly apologize. I'll play Armin's feedback now, and then we'll get the podcast finished. And I nearly did that, but I am sorry.
Hi, Terry. This is Armin. I hope you're doing really, really well. I've been a very, very lazy feedbacker the last couple of months, I guess. And it's just that life came in the way to some extent. And one of my intentions for the new year is actually to send in some more feedback to the podcasts that I listen most to and like the most, and that really means something to me. We really had a couple of fantastic episodes, and one I specifically wanted to comment on is the one who discussed The Haunted Palace with Vincent Price, which is, of course, based, as you mentioned, on the novel The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, which is one of my favorite HPL stories. And in general, I would say I really like this movie, although it's kind of limited set and kind of limited budget. But I think the crew, of course, besides Price himself, who's always good, always interesting to watch, is especially the lighting and the makeup job when he switches from his in-time persona to his previous self, or the cursed Joseph Curwen character. It's really nicely and subtly, but also convincingly done with especially this greenish kind of makeup that looks like corpse-like, supported by the lighting. I think, I don't know if you know it, but there is a more recent movie about the same story, which comes much, much closer to the story. And this is a movie called The Resurrected from 1991, which stars, I guess, the not-so-well-known John Terry, who plays the major role in this. And the movie is actually directed by Dan O'Bannon, who is, of course, famous for many, many things. But this is a movie which I can only highly advise, because it's very, very close to the original story. Of course, it's just transported into the 80s or 90s, so it's basically not any more historical story, but it's nicely done. It's really creepy, and it's really has a Lovecraft feel to it, I would say. And besides John Terry as the main guy, John March, there's also Chris Sarandon, who plays actually the title character, Charles Dexter Ward, as well as Joseph Curwen. And he really does a good job. I always enjoy watching him. So this is, comes highly advised. I thought a bit more about the general topic of Lovecraft movies. And, of course, you can separate into movies that specifically try to bring Lovecraft stories to life. Something like, let's say, Dagon, or... for instance, the possibly rarely seen The Call of Cthulhu from 2005, which is a black and white silent movie from post 2000, which is done basically, I think, by the guys from the H.P. Lovecraft Society and also the fantastic H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. So this is something in spirit very, very close to the original Lovecraft and his work. But there are also a lot of movies who just take over his ideas and try to build them into their own mythologies, like, let's say, in Hellboy or other movies of the same, which sometimes works well and sometimes not so nice. Generally, the movies I like doing something about Lovecraft, or really trying to put his work to film, are possibly Dagon by Stuart Gordon, which is also a low-budget affair, but is in spirit very, very close to his famous Innsmouth story, The Shadow over Innsmouth, just transported to Spain and the present. And to some extent, I would also say I like the Necronomicon movie, which is basically an anthology of three stories, which is a bit schlocky and not very, very close to his words, actually, but in spirit it's kind of close, but also very, very brutal and gory. Of course, I totally enjoy Jeffrey Combs as as Lovecraft himself, with a fantastic chin and just always like things like the knife cane and something like this. This is just fantastic. So, but I think if you want to come close in spirit, The Resurrected is a good watch, and also The Call of Cthulhu. But I guess there are tons of other movies out that just grabs this or that of his ideas and try to build it into their own story and mythology. So that's it for today. I hope you have a great time, great summer down there, down under, and I will try to send in much more feedback very soon. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, hi, Armin. Thank you for that. Yeah, you covered it pretty well. Dagon's an interesting film. I like that again. The Resurrected I haven't seen, but I do have a copy of, and I really should watch it. There are even movies like Cast a Deadly Spell and Witch Hunt, where the detective played by Fred Ward and Dennis Hopper in those two movies is Phil Lovecraft, and they do some very Cthulhu-y things in those two television movies that HBO did in the 1990s. There are any number of Lovecraft adaptations. Of course, he's in the public domain now, so anybody can have a go at it without too many problems. But yeah, it's I think that the mythology is much better than the writing sometimes with Lovecraft, because his writing was very kind of overblown and nebulous and evocative, but without being fantastically good. But it captured people's imaginations, that idea of elder gods and other dimensions and beings that are inimical to human life. Even things like Charlie Stross's Laundry series of books have a Lovecraft basis at their heart. So he has been incredibly influential as well. But they're all good recommendations, and thank you for that. And thank you for supporting the podcast, not only with the Patreon campaign, but by giving the feedback as well. Yeah, I really may have to revisit Lovecraft at some stage in a future podcast as well, because there's tons of stuff there. And the Reanimator movies may be one of those things that I do, because they're a lot of fun as well. But yeah, thank you for that, mate, and stay warm up there, okay? Anyway, that's about it for the podcast this time around. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you to Armin for the feedback. Thank you to the supporters. Thank you to movie fans in general. Thank you to the guys that made Deadpool. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Driving podcast, in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. Take care of yourselves out there, okay? Bye. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema and Martian Driving podcast, done in the style of movie credits. Thank you very much to all of the people who've supported the Patreon campaign, and you can do that too by going to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, who is our director of monster effects, and you can find his stuff at CushingHorrors.com, and Eric as our set security head, and David Luce is our First Amendment counsel. So thank you very much to all of the people who have supported the podcast financially via the Patreon campaign.